This is Vectis Radio.
For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Jack Whitewood. Jack is the Artistic Director of Ventnor Exchange and our very own Ventnor Fringe Festival. Welcome, Jack.
Hello.
Hello. It's lovely to talk to you because we've worked together a lot, so I'm very interested to find out what makes you tick. Because you are very young, aren't you?
26. Yeah. I like that that's still very young. Yes,
oh, it's very good. Young to me. But very young for somebody who holds, you know, a lot of responsibility and has a lot of respect on the island for in the area that you work.
Thank you.
How did you get to this heady position?
Wow, the plotted history. So I grew up on the island, and I've always been quite interested in theatre and performing arts. When I was little, we used to do lots of drama sessions and various things. And then as I got a bit older, I realised that it wasn't really performing that interested me so much as sort of the theatre as a building and as a space and the sort of community created in that. So my focus changed to being much more of an interest in sort of being involved in the making process. So in my late teens, I started getting really interested in writing, and I started writing a few little plays. And I sort of focused on what I thought would be the best route for what I want to do, and I had it in my heart that I really wanted to go to a drama school. And really kind of put a lot of effort into trying to make sure I got there. And
which one did you go to?
I went to Central School of Speech and Drama.
That's in London, isn't it?
It's in London. It's now the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, which was a controversial addition. I had a fantastic time there. I studied there for 3 years. And my course had a focus on directing and producing of work. We worked a lot with what they call the CDT actors, which is collaborative and devised theatre. And it was just a real eye-opener, really. It was an opportunity to see and witness lots of work in London, and to be, although I'd seen a few things, obviously being on the Isle of Wight, what you have access to is limited, and I'd had some trips to see shows on the mainland and things, but nothing compared to being able to live in London, having all of that.
So what were the eye-opening pieces that you saw when you were there?
Well, one of the great things I remember is the very first week that I started at Central, the school organised for us to go and see a show every single day. And it was a fantastic, really fantastic eye-opening experience, because they recognised that people's experience of what they'd seen would be very different. You know, people from get into the school from all around the world, and how much access they've had to theatre and what types of things they've seen will all be very different for different people. So there's this real leveller that every single day, for the first, I think it was the first 2 weeks actually, we went to go and see a piece of work selected by the school, and so it was a big variety of things.
Just sounds like heaven to me.
It was really amazing, and it sounds a bit like frivolous, but it was the sort of real ethos was that everyone needs to have their eyes opened. And because I think they were very conscious that people that moved to London might just go and see West End shows, and it was really important that you introduce not just to new work but to the venues in London that they thought are important,
of
that
course,
you need
and
to know
the
about.
Fringe venues too, presumably.
Exactly, yeah. And obviously London's a very big city, and when you arrive 18, starry-eyed, nervous, whatever, you sort of arrive in this big place, you don't know your way around very well, and not really the fringe areas or the sort of outer zones of what's going on. So it was a really fantastic experience, and during those 2 weeks was where I started straight away to form, to sort of really eye-open to different things. My interest in theatre had always been around new writing, but it opened up my eyes to types of work I'd never seen before. I remember a particular show at the Barbican by James Thierry, who's the great-grandson of Charlie Chaplin. He had a show called Raoul. It was a one-man show, a mime, essentially, and I was absolutely mesmerised. If someone said to me, would you like to go and see a mime, before that point, I would have said no.
No, thank you.
It was amazing, completely. And what I really enjoyed about it was, I wouldn't say it was necessarily something I even wanted to make, I just really enjoyed it as an audience, that he had me completely bewitched for nearly 2 hours without saying a single word. Things like that were a real eye-opener. They took us to opera, to ballet, and it's the sort of things where you have a massive you know, you have a preconceived opinion of what you think about these things, but they're really good at introducing you to these art forms in a different way and just making you be open, really. And it was 3 years of being questioning yourself, exploring yourself, and being very open, being very... and that was a difficult process because everyone has their inhibitions and everyone has their... you know, things that they're happy to explore and things less so, and it was a really good 3 years.
What did you discover about yourself then that came as perhaps a bit of a surprise?
I think when I started, I had views about what I like and what I don't like and what I am interested in and what I'm not interested in, and it was 3 years of challenging that, really, and being always looking at another side to every story, always giving everything a go, always... always taking things another step further, pushing yourself further than you think you can go.
So drama school taught you that?
Yeah, made me much more resilient, and I think it made
me... It sounds like everybody should do that course, Jack, if that's what it teaches.
Yeah, it's surprisingly... I mean, obviously there was a lot about techniques and skills and craft, but the biggest thing I would take from it is... a self-confidence and a more maturity with that. I think with a drama school, particularly on acting courses, people that get in are, you know, can be quite confident and maybe too confident, and it's about instilling a more genuine confidence that isn't bravado and isn't that stereotype that you have of a performing arts place. It's about a much more genuine, sincere confidence, because, you know, anything... while you're in the public domain, you know, you're on stage or you're performing to people, it's a very vulnerable position you're put in. It's quite exposing, and you need to be able to, in a very mature way, be able to be comfortable with that. And from my perspective as a creator, it's important that I have sympathy and understand that role that performers are put in, so that anything I'm asking a performer to do, I can sort of relate to and to a certain extent understand the position that I'm putting them in.
So you did acting as part of the course?
Yeah, to an extent, yes. Yeah. So it was less about doing acting and more about understanding the processes that they're going through. So it was more about their understanding their training than particularly about understanding or practicing how to act.
Yes,
so that was the most... it was a really valuable experience, and it's a good lesson in life, obviously, anyway, being able to have empathy and understand the position of other people and what you're asking people to do.
And what about coping with criticism? Do you think having, I suppose, perhaps you've answered it in that you said it builds your confidence, and do you think that confidence would then help? Because obviously you are very much in the public eye as an actor or a director. Once you put your work out there. So do you think having that training at drama school helped you deal with any adverse criticism?
Definitely, you have to be prepared to be criticised all the time. Yeah. And have lots of people scrutinise you. I mean, it was really good because I, you know, not being an actor, it's not something that I do, and I felt that was something that wouldn't ever really affect me in any way. Mm. But actually, you know, particularly in a small place like the projects that I've done since here on the island, where you're, you know, people do know who you are, even if you're not the person on the stage, and they sort of involved in, if you're involved heavily in community projects and things, people are more aware of you, and then people decide, you know, people always have criticisms, people always have suggestions, and yeah, you just have to be able to take those on board seriously, maturely, and be comfortable with taking on criticism. You know, it can be a massive positive that if you get criticism that you can really take on board, or that you can, you know, it gives an outside opinion on what you're doing, so it can be really helpful. But yeah, it was a great opportunity for that.
So who do you collaborate with on the island in terms of the arts?
Who do we collaborate with? Lots of people, really. So I work with a team of six friends, or me and five other friends, who run the Ventnor Exchange and the Ventnor Fringe Festival, and now the new Ventnor International Festival. So I guess they're my first and foremost kind of core collaborators.
So you call them friends. Were you friends before you set this whole organisation up?
Weirdly, not really. So I mean, most of us have known each other for years, and we're all of the same age and went to the same schools, but we weren't really friends at school. So we've commented on this ourselves lots of times where we sort of sat and worked out how and why we're doing what we're doing. And we weren't really friends at school. It was only kind of during university periods, so kind of between 18 and 21, where we really got to know each other.
Was that when you came back to the island for the holidays and things?
Yeah, we would come back. So we, the very first, in 2010, I think it was, we'd just all gone off to different universities. And just before we went off to universities, when we first sort of started speaking to each other, for whatever reason, I can't even remember why now, there was a couple of events that we all went to, or we sort of loosely knew each other as acquaintances and sort of knew each other from school, but weren't really close friends. And from that, we all sort of had this idea that we wanted a reason to come back in the summer holidays. So we set up the Fringe primarily for our own interest of the idea of having some purpose to come back to at the summer holidays. And I'd written a couple of plays just before that, and I had a little bit of money left over from those. I think it was about £2,000 that we'd accumulated from a couple of years of doing little plays and drama workshops and things. And I was going off to university, and I wasn't allowed to just keep the money for me because it had been through a group that we'd made. Yeah. So I had to put it to some sort of good purpose. So we said, oh, let's run a little event. So the first festival was run with a starting budget of £2,000, a few of us just wanting a reason to come back in the summer. And it was such a memorable, special week that it's sort of stayed ever since. And since then, obviously, grown and expanded, but that was really all it started as.
So from those early days, I know it is huge in comparison. How much is it in terms of figures?
Well, in 2010, the first year, we had, I think, around 50 performers at the festival. It was 3.5 days long. I think we sold just over 200 tickets. And it was, I remember us printing the programme on the first day of the festival in Thea's house in her living room. So it's grown a lot. This year, 2016... we had just under 400 performers. It's 6 days, and we have around 3,500 people at the festival now. So it's definitely sort of expanded gradually over time. And in the last 2 years, we've also had the Exchange to run, and that's expanded again, another whole range of things. So it's now quite a big project. Two of us are now employed within it, and it's particularly in the last sort of 12 to 24 months, it's really grown a lot. So it's become quite a leap, really, into a more professional world.
And it's an all-year-round venue, isn't it?
Yeah, the Exchange is an all-year-round venue. We opened just over 2 years ago, and it's in the old post office building in Ventnor, which was a real mess. We had no intention of opening that space. So 2 years ago, we got to the point where we had accumulated lots of stuff from the Fringe Festival. So I remember in our front room we had about 5 pianos, loads of sofas, boxes and boxes of bunting, so much bunting, and we desperately needed some storage. So what we were really looking for was a space to start storing some things. And we had the idea that it would be really great to have a small office, because this was after we just finished university, so we just moved back, and we decided that we wanted to have a go of it and spend at least a year just seeing if we could really make it work. And our house was quite full, so we really wanted to find an office, and we didn't really like living and working together in the same house. It was all a bit intense. People would phone the home line all the time.
Yeah.
So we were trying to find an office, but we couldn't really find anywhere in Ventnor that we thought was suitable. We were just starting to think about maybe moving out of Ventnor when this old post office building sort of reared its head, and we'd written it off as being far too large. But the landlord was really keen to get somebody in. And so we looked around and were somehow persuaded that it was a good idea to take on. And it needed a lot of work. It had been empty for about 2 years. It's a beautiful Victorian building that had sort of the 80s happen to it. So it had, false ceilings with horrible strip lights, lots of false walls, unnecessary panelling, horrific carpets, just generally ruining everything about a really attractive building. So we set to work starting to strip it back and starting to renovate it, which is an ongoing process. Looks a lot better now than it did, but it's still lots to do. And because it was larger, it couldn't just be an office, so it became a sort of art centre, really, which is the first for Ventnor, the first art centre it's ever had. Combines a 50-seat studio theatre. We have it open as a sort of bar with a craft beer influence every day.
I think that's very popular, your craft beer, isn't it, from what
I
can gather?
Yes, it's very popular. Well, it's not really taken off on the Isle of Wight, which is surprising, because most of the country, craft beer's had this sort of big thing, and we seem to be one of the only places really doing it in a big way. Although, I mean, craft beer's one of those sort of things that some people wince their nose up because it's a bit of a cliche, but in reality, a lot of the beer that we have is we call craft beer because it's an easy way of describing it, but really it's kind of international, and it's specialty beer. But we have a lot of Belgian and German beers, and I think most of the monastery Belgian beers would not call themselves craft beer. They would find that term, they've been running for hundreds and hundreds of years, so I don't think they would really describe themselves as a craft microbrewery. But it's an easy way to sort of explain it to people. But we have a lot of Trappist ales and imported German.
Good coffee, too.
Good coffee. That's mostly Island coffee. So we have the bar, and we also have a record store as well. And interested in making, I think it's important that an art space is not austere, or some people feel uncomfortable going into an art space, and we have a columned building with big double doors, so there's a danger of it being something people don't feel comfortable going into. So we really wanted to make it a very informal space that was very sociable, and part of having this active sort of bar and store environment was about making it that if you've never been to see a show, you can still feel comfortable going into the space and being there.
Oh, it's a lovely space, isn't it? I mean, having been an audience member and performed there, you've got these lovely old squashy sofas. It's very chilled out there, isn't it?
It's very relaxed. We wanted an environment that was different to a pub and different to a sort of late bar. It was trying to find a sort of balance where people feel comfortable, and also it had to represent the audience that come to the Fringe. That was the audience we'd built over 5 years or so, and it's a very mixed age range, our audience, and so we needed to make a space where we felt people of all different ages would feel comfortable and enjoy the space equally. And so there's that a certain amount of thought had to go into that, because I think a lot of spaces certain groups of people won't ever go into. It's trying to tackle that.
I think you've done it really, really well. And often you turn it into a gallery, don't you? Have art, pieces of art up there.
Yeah, our poor walls get there. A regular beating.
It's a really accessible space. And I also think that you guys as a team are very, you're all very welcoming. It's all very informal. Although you run a very tight ship, the way you do it, it is for artists, you're very approachable, and I think that makes a world of difference.
That's lovely to hear. I mean, we try to be I think the key thing is that it's about being really, it's about, again, that sort of sincerity. And I think sometimes in an effort to make things kind of like cool places, there's a sort of falseness about it, and that's what people really don't like. First and foremost, our space is a making space. We use it to create and develop new work. The reason why there's clutter in parts of it is because we're busy making things and we're doing things, so people can come in and see, puppets being built or bits of set being painted or bits of the building are still being renovated all the time. But it's very real, and I think some people really appreciate that and like that. We don't hide it.
It's an ever-changing, evolving space. I feel when I come. Yeah,
and it's for us primarily it's our workspace that we invite people to come into to use as a bar in the evenings, but it wasn't built to be a bar as such. It is first and foremost a creative space for us to make work, and I think that's important because that gives it the lived-in atmosphere that I think.
And you have such an eclectic mix of shows, don't you? I mean, everything from Doubting Derricks to not exactly pantomimes, but plays and
all sorts of. I mean, in the last year, we've been going over what we've put on the last 2 years, and we've been really proud of the work we put on. From we've had shows from as far away as Canada, from France, from a lady from Afghanistan recently. So it's been a big international flavour. We've had some really big companies like Payne's Plough, and the poet Luke Wright, people that are pretty established artists that wouldn't really perform in spaces as small as ours normally, right through to a lot of support for local performers and artists. as well as commissioning new works. So we try every year to commission a certain number of new pieces of work as well. So as well as visiting shows, they're pieces of work that we've instigated and commissioned actors or writers or designers, whoever, to make. And that's important because we couldn't really see that anywhere on the island at the moment. There's quite a vibrant amateur dramatic scene. There's larger venues like at Shanklin and the Medina Theatre, but they're hosting visiting touring work. They're not making anything, they're really just venues. And we really, to me, a theatre is not just a venue, it's a place that makes and creates work.
Yes.
So that's an important
and
part
I think
it.
Allows people to develop that work and evolve.
Yeah.
So it may not be shiny, some of it may not be finished, totally finished piece of work.
Stages. So I mean, we run a residency program, so we host visiting artists who come and spend varying times, normally around sort of 3 weeks with us in Ventnor to develop a new piece of work. And that's been a really enjoyable process where, yeah, the final product is at different stages. We just did worked with a poet called Toby Thompson, who's originally from Bath. Really talented young guy. We think he's going to do really well.
Is he the one that was performing in the caravan?
He was. He performed in the caravan at the Fringe this year.
A very beautiful caravan, I might add.
Debbie, I think she's called. We're really excited to work with him, and the piece that we ended up with that is at a sort of scratch level. It's about 40 minutes, needs a bit more work, but we're really pleased with what there is. But we like trying to find talent and then nurturing it and trying to help it succeed. That's kind of what really excites us, and what really excites me is helping make something happen. And I think it's also really important we try not to make a distinction too much between whether somebody is a local or a visiting artist. So in all of the commissions, we always combine a mixture of artists from the island and artists from off the island. And I think it's really important because otherwise you end up with a very, sort of same pool of people over and over just rolling around. And it's not very conducive, I don't think, to new ideas and new processes. So
what
we really try and mix people.
You've obviously got a pool of artists. There's always people who want to perform. But what about getting an audience to watch those people perform? Because I think that's always more difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, our observations have been since moving back to the island and setting up the exchange that there has not been a lot of audience development here. And there is not really a very large ready audience for contemporary work at all, and that's been a real challenge to sort of build up. It's been exciting to see it build, though. Now we can put on shows and pretty much guarantee that they'll sell out, which is fantastic. When we started 2 years ago, you were getting 5-6 people to things, and you felt like this was going to be a difficult job. We're only a small 50-seat space, but we can now pretty much guarantee that anything that we put on will almost always sell out or be pretty much full, and we can only do a couple of days.
That's brilliant.
So that's been really exciting to see that develop slowly. It is a real challenge, and I think that part of the reason why it's so difficult is because there hasn't been, the role of a producer is misunderstood and not really available on the island. So you have a lot of people which are interested as creatives or as artists, but a really key part, particularly in theatre, of the process is the producer, is the people that are making it happen. And I think there's the caricature of like the evil money making person, but in reality, particularly at the level that we're talking, regional small scale level, the producers are people that really help make things happen. They're the ones obtaining the funding and the sponsorship and getting the buildings together, and they're a really key part of the operation.
Absolutely, it's that unseen stuff that goes on, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's trying to build up although we are creatives and we all have our own artistic practice, primarily we are a team of producers, and I think we work hard to try and build up a level of mutual respect and trust between artists and us as a team of producers, and that both need each other in order to be able to make something happen. And I think that's the key to to building audiences in the future, us sharing the skills that we have with the talent that artists have. And that's a really important relationship. But behind every great artist, there are people helping make their career happen. It's very rare that it's just fluke that somebody
does very well. Yeah, it's the right team.
Yeah.
We were talking off air. You said to me something quite interesting. You felt that the sofa was your main... That was your main competition when it came to dragging an audience out of the house. It was getting them off out of
there. Well, that came from a conversation recently with someone. Someone said to me that they were organising a poetry night in Ryde, and they got in touch, which is very sweet of them to say, yeah, we don't want to tread on your toes, and we know you do some poetry at the Event Exchange, and is that okay? And just checking the dates, and I was saying to them, you know, it's, I really don't think that a poetry night in Ryde is our competition at all. Our competition is the sofa, it's the X Factor, it's the Great British Bake Off, it's the Xbox, it's Facebook. And they're our competition. And I think that it's important that all arts organisations, you know, notice that. It's not the other arts providers which are the competition at all. As far as I'm concerned, the more that people go out and see live music, the more they go to see theatre and performing arts, the more they're going out just generally as a in an evening, and the more likely they are to come to us as well. So I'm keen to encourage people to go to any live activity on the island, because I think they'll be much more likely to be open to the idea of coming to us as a result of that, providing they have a good experience. And I think, I think that's a view that increasingly everyone is coming to, that it's important that we all acknowledge that. And these days, that is the competition. It's the computer, it's the TV, it's the sofa.
It's a hell of a isn't it, to compete with?
Well, they're very convenient. So that's the, you know, it's very easy on a warm and cozy cold day to go, oh, I'm just going to stay. And, you know, everyone's fallen into that trap now and again. I think it's a very easy thing to do. We've got to show that. There is a value in the live, in something being in being,
being
in the present and in
there,
what's
in
that moment,
first hand.
Like
watching Maggie Smith on Downton Abbey, wonderful, but nothing like when I saw her in Lettuce in Lovage, probably in the early 80s at the theatre when I just started work in Soho, and with Francis de la Tour. So to see those two greats, who were great even, you know, back then obviously as well, was just mind-boggling.
When you see, I remember the first time I saw Mark Rylance performing, that really stood out for me, as I was just like, this is, it's just so much, it's so different being live and in
absolutely
the moment and seeing that person. And it's the same as going to a live gig or a festival. Obviously I enjoy listening to things on my headphones, but nothing really beats being in the atmosphere and seeing it live.
Okay, thank you, Jack. So we're going to be hearing a lot more from Jack Whitewood after this break. Stay tuned.
Stay social and get in touch. It's at Vectors Radio on Twitter. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello and welcome back to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my guest, Jack Whitewood, who is the Artistic Director of Ventnor Fringe and the Ventnor Exchange. And Jack has just been taken by the enormous record collection behind him here in the studio. Find anything interesting there?
Yeah, I just realised I'm sat in front of a massive record collection, which I didn't realise.
That's another of your passions, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's a bad habit to get into, though, because it's quite expensive.
What, vinyl?
Yeah. Well, we actually did a little experiment the other day, because, I mean, nowadays, a sort of a full-length album, LP, will cost probably about £20. And someone was saying, complaining about how outrageously expensive everything is. So we did a comparison to 1969, and if you take into account the price difference, a record would cost £30 today by 1969 prices. So they've actually gone down in price.
Oh, wow.
But it's interesting because it shows how much people did spend on music, which is, I think, on physical music.
Yes.
Quite, and how much we now devalue. I think Spotify pays 0.01p or something per play. So how much that's devalued is crazy, really.
But are there far more people listening into Spotify than there were buying music back in the day?
I guess
it's
so,
all relative,
but it's kind of relative. So it's a bit of a strange world, really. It's just that we don't value the cost of that as much now. It's just we're used to having things available freely, but I think also if you think about it, today we just have so much more stuff.
I know.
You know, we own so much
and
more things,
and it's also disposable, isn't it?
Yeah, Yeah, so before I think you would save up and buy something that you really want. Yeah. Now it's just very throwaway.
I used to work all day in Boots, so where were we? Back in the late 70s, Boots Chemist in London, and then I would spend my wages up when they used to sell, do you remember, well you don't remember when they used to sell records in Boots, do you Jack? No, because you're 26.
No, I don't remember that.
Well they did, and I used to wait for the latest David Essex to come out,
yeah,
and then spend all my wages of that day, so that was money well spent, and that was about £3, £3.50 I think I used to earn for a day's yeah. work.
Wow.
Yeah. But just to look at those dreamy eyes, it was worth
it. But when you think
everything.
Now, have you spent a whole day's wages on a record now, you know, it's the kind of, that's the equivalent. It's people kind of differentiate between, why is it not £3.50 now? But when you take into account
the
proportion of their income, what people were spending, it's quite different, really.
And you learnt to play the accordion, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm not very good.
I'm saying that with a smile in my voice. And
I'm not going to give a demo.
thank goodness. I know you didn't lug it in. But it's, to me, that instrument is like, I don't know what I'm laughing for because I certainly couldn't play it, but it's like the equivalent of sort of patting your head and rubbing your tummy. And I am doing that now in front, but not very well.
Yeah, there's three processes at the same time, which I'm left-handed, but I...
Oh, so just to make it even more complicated.
Yeah, it's a really ridiculous instrument because I'm left-handed, but I actually use my right hand for everything, and I just write with my left hand. And
so you're ambidextrous?
Well, not really, because I can't write with my right hand, so I'm just cack-handed, I think. It's more realistic. So yeah, it's not really a sensible first instrument to learn to play, but I was really fascinated. I was obsessed with bands like Beirut, and so I really wanted to play the accordion.
Do you get it out at Christmas and give everybody a quick
No, I spare my family that embarrassment. I haven't really played very much recently. I used to do lessons, and I used to kind of be a bit more into it. I haven't played it so much recently. I need to get back on it.
So might we hear the renditions up at the Ventnor Exchange anytime soon?
Only when no one's there.
So coming up to Christmas, I know you've got a nice Christmas show coming up there, haven't you?
Yeah, we've just announced that. We have last year we did our first Christmas show. It's called Goodnight Little Bear, which went really well. It was had a lot of puppetry in it. It was very visual, had a lot of animation. We wanted a Christmas show on the island that wasn't a pantomime, wasn't a musical, something a bit different for people, an original news story. So we're keeping with the same kind of ethos. We've created a new show this year, or we're about to. It's called The Boy Who Didn't Like Sweets. Very inspired by the stories of Roald Dahl, a sort of gruesome, a bit more gruesome and a bit more, I like the idea of this world of sweets. So it's about two twins, and they're left in charge of a sweet shop due to some unfortunate circumstances, and they're told that they mustn't eat any sweets from the top shelf. So what could possibly go wrong?
I can't imagine. So this is aimed at kids, obviously, parents, so it's that perfect Christmas audience.
Yeah, we're kind of targeting it at kind of 6 to 12 year olds, but it's always made with the whole family in mind, and a lot of our shows, including this one, have a fair bit of puppetry and sort of visual work in them, which we get a lot of adults come to, even without children, that like to see the puppetry, so it's not by any means an exclusively children's show, but yes, it's the story and narrative is aimed at a family audience.
Fantastic. And those tickets are available now?
They are available now, yes. They're from our website.
And your website is?
www.ventnorexchange.co.uk.
What else? Brilliant. And I think you also told me that you said your applications for the Ventnor Fringe, they're opening in January 2017.
Yeah, they are. So the 8th, can you believe it, Ventnor Fringe, next August. Applications to take part open in January. We have an open application process, so I should probably explain a little bit about what a Fringe is. So we're, unlike a traditional festival where a sort of promoter books everything and then charges a ticket sale, with a Fringe, in the same way as in Edinburgh or in Brighton, artists keep 100% of their own ticket sales. So any artist of any creative discipline, whether you're a painter or a musician or a theatre maker or a poet, can apply. There's a small application fee, It's between £40 and £60, depending on how many performances you're doing, to apply to the festival. And that includes, with that, you get a whole sort of package of discounts and advertising, the programme, all the box office services, all those kind of things. And we help you find a suitable venue. We make pop-up venues all over the town.
And the artist pays for the venue?
Pardon?
Does the artist pay for the venue?
Yeah, some venues are free, some venues are higher fees. They vary depending on what you require. So an artist that requires a full sound rig and system and a sound man with a 300-seat capacity is obviously going to be paying more than somebody that wants a back room to do a recital. So it varies according. Everything is done according to what people need.
And you're open to everybody, every application?
Yep, anyone can apply. Yeah. We don't make a judgment on the work, so there's no sort of judging panel.
And that's the same as the Edinburgh Fringe?
Same principles as Edinburgh Brighton Fringe. Yeah. The only reason shows are ever turned down is if we physically can't find a suitable space. It's normally very large-scale work, so if there's pieces sometimes from the mainland which are a bit too large for the capacity we can provide. That's really the only reason why things get restricted. Or if someone was proposing something outrageously illegal, we'd probably have to say no.
Of course. You had, talking of the smaller venues, you had the probably most unique venue I've ever watched a performance in. A friend of mine, Annie Robinson, little Annie, was doing, playing her guitar and singing beautifully on the Cascade.
Oh, yeah.
What do you call that? That's not the bus stop, is it? What do you call that?
We call it the Reaney Stage.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, yes. It's the Reaney Howell Walk. Yes. So we call it the Reaney Stage. It looks like a bus shelter. Everyone calls it a bus shelter.
But you couldn't get a bus
there's
down
nowhere
there.
No way a bus will get anywhere near it, but yeah.
And I think it was festooned with velvet drapes.
Yes.
Just beautiful. And because people are coming down there, you know, the world and his wife and his dog literally were coming down there and then all stopping to listen to a song and moving on and then coming back. And it was just delightful. It was really, and you've got the sea as your backdrop.
It's a lovely place to sit and play. I think that when we were growing up, we grew up as the, you know, new Isle of Wight Festival and Best of All were growing, and we were really excited by those. And I worked for a little while at a couple of music festivals around the country. But I'm actually much more interested in urban festivals, because a field festival, that you know, the your site is essentially a blank canvas and you can create whatever you want. But what I like about an urban environment is you don't have a blank canvas. You have a canvas filled with people that live, work and breathe the town or city that they're in. And it creates all sorts of different challenges, but I think it makes it much more exciting and much more lived in. So I love festivals in urban centres and how you transform the spaces which people use every day into something different. I'd like to think that during the Week of the Fringe, people that you know, walk down Ventnor High Street every single day are able to use it in a different way, or they're allowed to go into buildings they're not normally allowed to go into. The spaces that they're used to seeing used in the same way are used in a different way. You know, one of our most popular venues at the whole festival is the Laundrette, which people love to go and watch gigs in. And it's just the fact that there's always some great bands playing there, and people love to be able to go and sit in the Laundrette and watch some gigs. And there's actually a really important lesson from that, because
it's also next to the ice cream shop, Jack.
Did some excellent Fringe ice creams this year. There's a really important lesson about the Laundrette, actually, because it's not just about the sort of quirkiness of doing something somewhere different. It's also about engaging with the community. And when you're trying to think of where people socialise, the obvious place people that always say is pubs, bars, cafes, but not everyone goes to pubs and cafes. And so you kind of start to think of where else are the sort of social spaces that people meet. And when you think about it, they're often not the obvious places. And we found that the Laundrette was a really key social space for a whole group of people that every morning are in the Laundrette. And that's a different, they have a different time cycle, it's a different group of people. Sometimes it's a certain bus stop. Sometimes it's not the obvious places, you know. And so when we think about where we want to promote and where we want to do things, posters in pubs is not always the first port of call. Sometimes where we're thinking is actually, where is the real places that people always bump into each other and see each other? Maybe it's a certain part of the park. Maybe it's...
Have you ever done anything actually on the beach, like they do at Brighton?
Yeah, we have. We have... our beach is more tidal than Brighton, so the tide comes right to the... to the Esplanade, so it's a little bit more restricted. We've had some very strange performances on the beach. We had a Japanese company once that took over a beach hut, and they had the orchestra of tiny instruments, and they built these They were literally like the size of your sort of top of your finger, and they play and they worked, and they did a concert in there, which was great. We had a performance piece once on the beach where there was the story of a wedding that happens on this beach. So we have had a few things.
I wonder if you could do like a mimic theatre type thing for the festival.
But yeah, that'd be great. It's a bit hard actually on the beach. There's lots of things I would love to do. I'd love to have something on the water, but it is very temperamental, that tide, so you've got to be a bit careful. But we have the harbour where we have the big observatory bar space,
so. And that looks beautiful because you have it all bedecked with fairy lights and deck chairs, don't you?
Yeah,
the whole event just comes alive when you come in on the festival days and evenings. You know something special is happening, and it's all got this kind of warmth and this glow about it, and people are just embrace everything about, I don't know, it's a bit like Christmas, you know, everybody's a little bit of magic's happening, everybody's being really lovely and embracing and accepting, and because it's so tiny, and it's just it's an odd shaped place, isn't it, Ventnor?
Yeah.
It's very beautiful and it's very different, and it's set up on a hill and it's set by the sea, and it's got those little nooks and crannies to have those special venues that you were talking about in.
Definitely, it's nice to make people rediscover somewhere they think they know.
Yes.
Just because something is always used every day for a certain purpose doesn't mean it always has to be. It's like at night when there's no traffic around and you can walk in the middle of the road, and it's sort of a weird liberating feeling that you're allowed to do something you're not normally allowed to do.
That's right.
And it's that same kind of ethos. We've had things where we've let people go into the library at midnight for events, or we've, you know, turning the harbour into this sort of barren space into a 360-degree cocktail bar. Using the park in a way that people can engage with it more. It's trying to find the spaces that we use all the time, but using them in a different way. And I think, that's what makes the week really special. That you can imagine things in a different way.
You think, why can't it be like this more of the time? it is like that Christmas magic descends in the middle of summer. That's how I feel about it. And when I performed there with Donna Jones last year, and we were in the Ventnor Winter Gardens, and obviously that's been closed for a while. I know it's reopened, but it was closed for a long time to us.
Yeah.
So that was a joy to get in there and to get up into the long room where we were.
And we had a little event on the rooftop, which is the first time something's been done on the roof in about 20 years. I'm hoping we can use Winter Gardens more next year.
Yeah.
without, you know, changing the ethos of lots of small intimate spaces, it's an important space to engage in the festival and have involved with it.
We had the view, of course, because you've got the views out to sea from there.
Yeah.
And I said to Donna, nobody can compete with that. We had to pull all the blinds down in the early evening. But it was the only way, because it was just such gorgeous, gorgeous views. But we had some up, some down. It was lovely. But it was the long room, and we weren't sure. We went to visit the venue because Donna was unfamiliar with it. So we went to visit it the day before the show. And we didn't know how many tickets we'd sold. We thought, well, goodness, you know, it's quite a big venue to fill. Perhaps we could have just done it in the short room. Don't know if there is one, but that would have done. And Donna was saying, well, we could just do it on the landing, you know, or we could just do it on the steps. No, but so it was just so wonderful the night of the show when we walked in, and it was a sellout, and they were such a lovely audience. They were so warm and receptive and giving, and I think that again is very characteristic of the Ventnor Fringe, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's funny as well that you call it Longley, because we rename everything at the festival, and it's so funny hearing people describe places by their festival name but not by their real name, which I love. I think it's fantastic. We get a lot of people come into the Exchange throughout the year, particularly tourists, and they'll be describing places which are what we call them for the festival. So
things
like the harbour in particular, people always call the observatory. It's not called that's just the festival's name for it. But I love that people call it the observatory in the rest of the year.
that's brilliant. So you take the town over in the nicest possible way, don't you? It just becomes your play place, really.
We get given some keys to lots of places to sort of transform it. But what's also great is that, you know, to start with, when we first began the festival, people were a bit nervous and reserved about what we wanted to do, and now I think, you know, we get people approach us asking us to put something on in their shop, asking us to sort of take over their space, which is, you know, lovely. And if anything, now it's us trying to catch up with what people want to be able to do.
And it must be great for all the restaurants and cafes and bars who aren't venues, but where people are just going to hang out, you know, between shows.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously not being an enclosed site means that people are just in and around Ventnor, and that's nice because they get to do that. And I like that, you know, we have like a daily newspaper, and it's nice to see that in the restaurants and cafes around. So it is very much like the Fringe's influences in all these places, even if there's not shows. The other thing that I think is really important, as well as sort of aesthetically changing the town, is the influx of creatives and artists from all over, and it's an opportunity, I think, for lots of local artists to meet people from elsewhere, and I think that's a really important part of it as well. So just over 50% of the artists that take part in the Fringe come from off the island, and they're all around and hanging out in the town, and I think it's really great that they meet so many different people, and it's that atmosphere that I really like as well, that there's this influx of people from all over meeting with the local people, and that sort of that combination and mix.
Yeah,
I think
you
is
get
really
that
exciting.
Real energy, yeah. Don't you, when you come through? And of course, it's carnival time, isn't it?
Yep. So we have we run alongside the Ventnor Carnival celebrations, which run on the Wednesday and the Saturday night every year. So yeah, a lot of extra people for those as well.
And your staff, but your helpers, that magnifies as well, doesn't it? You have extra people coming in, like Neary.
Yeah, during the week we have quite a big extra. It was about we have about 30 volunteers running working on the event, and then on top of that we have bar staff and security staff, and you know, there's quite a big, by the whole team's over 50. So
they all seem really loyal and want to be part of it. Come back year on year.
A lot come back year after year. Well, interestingly though, the vast majority of people that volunteer at the festival are not from the island, so it'd be great to have some more islanders get involved in volunteering at the festival, because most come from all over the country to come and take part, which is amazing. And the thing is, once a lot of come down once and then come back with another friend, and then come back another year with another friend, but the big core of all those young volunteers that you see working at the festival, the vast majority of them are not from the island, which is quite interesting in a way.
I think I've always got the impression that they're your team, and that you're sorted. So it's interesting to know. So if there's anybody listening that would like to get involved, obviously pop in and see.
Yeah,
Jack,
we're always keen
at the old post office
to get more volunteers involved, definitely. And also next year we're looking at starting to introduce one or two apprenticeship roles at the exchange, which are kind of aimed at sort of entry level jobs, but we're really keen to help train up other people that are interested in working in the arts, so they'll be keep posted on that, but there will be opportunities next year in that area as well.
Brilliant, because I was just about to ask you what your future plans are, because obviously you're so young, but you're very dynamic, and you know, you're real entrepreneur, aren't you? And you don't let anything hold you back. You're just such a positive person, so you must have lots of plans going forward.
Yeah, well, we've got a really busy year coming up, because we've taken on a lot of different projects. It started very much as a week festival. Now, as well as having this sort of year-round art space, I think the future for the exchange is trying to embed that ethos and culture throughout the whole year, and trying to be a more active part in our community and society and changing it for the better. So I think we'll be doing a lot more with schools and with training. I'm really shocked and appalled by the figures that came out this week about child poverty on the island, and it makes me really angry and sad, really, that there's that there is so much poverty and sort of a real lack of opportunities for young people on the island. And so I'm really keen for us to, you know, play our part in trying to help that in some small way, because I think it's really important that people give back to their place and really try and invest in it. So they'll be a big part of that. And then also we're working hard to try and export more work. So we've got our first shows that we've made that are starting to get bookings on the mainland. So that means we're able to start exporting work, which is really exciting, because it has the sort of Ventnor Exchange and the Isle of Wight brand attached to them wherever they go. And then independently of that, I've got a lot of different projects on the go for things that are going to be happening next year. So it's getting busier and busier every year.
Brilliant. And I don't know, because of who you are and how clearly ambitious you are, I'm now getting a bit worried, Jack, that we're going to lose you.
I think I've always got an attachment to the island, so I don't think that will ever, ever change. And I think it's really important that once you set out to do something that you complete it. Arguably things are never complete, but I don't like starting things and not finishing them. So
do you have a time frame in mind for what you deem to be finishing the project?
I think we want to make sure that the Fringe and the Exchange get to a point where they are completely stable and will exist in perpetuity. That's not the right word. Beyond us. So I think it's really important that they, when we move on or get old or do other things, that it can exist beyond us, and that it's not our, we never set up the exchange or the fringes just to be our personal creative project. They're there for the island and for the town and wider. They're there for the artists that we serve, and they should exist beyond our time running them. So until that stage, we'll be there until we have people that are able to take them on, because that's really important to us, that it doesn't all end. It's been way too hard for it to end.
No, I can't imagine that. That would be a real tragedy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's your baby, so you need to.
But I think it's there's been so much time and investment by so many people to make something work against the odds, really, that we wouldn't let that go. So it has to be passed.
I, for one, and I'm sure many of our listeners, especially those who've experienced the Fringe and been to the Exchange, are very reassured to hear that and very delighted. And I'm really glad that that place is in such capable hands. You know, you and the team just do a remarkable job. And I think you put your heart and soul into it, and that's what's different. It's more than just a job to you guys, isn't it? It is a passion.
Completely, yeah. It's not really a job at all.
We've sat here, and I was determined I was going to find out what made you tick. And I know this place makes you tick, but we haven't even scratched the surface of you underneath that, because this is you. This is what you're all about at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty all-consuming, because it's something that takes up a lot, pretty much all of our time. But also, it's so important that we make it work.
Yeah, and it's very important for us that you're there. So thank you so much for all that you do, and thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack. And next week, thank you so much for listening, and next week, please listen in when I'll be talking to Paul Armfield, who perhaps is sort of slightly Jack's opposite number over at Key Arts, as well as being a wonderful musician and a very familiar face on the island. So I'm really looking forward to that one. Have a wonderful weekend and enjoy what's left of this winter sunshine. Bye-bye. www.vectisradio.com